Today I will mostly talk about my work with my student Guido Festuccia, but our work has built on lots of insight from many earlier papers. So my plan for today is I will first give you a brief description, just remind you how to describe gravitational collapse and an internal black hole using ADS-CFT. And then I will describe the difficulties and then the strategy of using ADS-CFT to understand black hole singularities. And then I will discuss some manifestations of black hole singularities we found in Yang-Mills series. And the possible resolutions of singularities, say in quantum gravity. And then if you have some time, I will talk about some issues in the large N limit of a Yang-Mills theory. So let's start with ADS-CFT correspondence, just to remind you some basic fact. Say this is a statement between N equal to 4 super Yang-Mills theory, say on a three-dimensional sphere with a gauge group SUN, with a quantum gravity in five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. So the parameter, important parameter in Yang-Mills theory side is N squared, which is a number of color, N is a number of color. And R is the curvature radius in ADS, and LP is the Planck scale. So 1 over N squared is the parameter which controls how important the quantum gravitational correction is. And another important parameter from Yang-Mills theory side is so-called two-hook coupling. And this is related to the ratio between the curvature radius and the string scale, the string length. So the lambda tells you, so 1 over lambda tells you how important the string correction is. So two very important approximations you should keep in mind. So one is the so-called classical gravity approximation. So this is the approximation that the Planck scale is very small, Planck length and string length is very small. So that corresponds to angle to infinity, and the lambda goes to infinity limit. So in this limit from the ADS point of view, so this is essentially quantum field theory in a rigid curved space-time. And there's another limit, which is purely large N limit, which you can take lambda to be any value. So this is a classical string approximation. So that's corresponding to, say, strings propagating in the rigid curved space-time. So this is a very, again, some very some basic dictionary between these two theories. When we say these two theories are equivalent, we say any Yang-Mills theory, say state, should be one-to-one correspondence with whatever quantum state you can describe in this quantum gravitational theory. And also, if you have some field which propagate in ADS that are related to, that is corresponding to some gauge invariant operator in the Yang-Mills theory. And the mass of this field is then mapped to the conformal dimension of this operator. And also the scattering amplitude of such particles in ADS then are related to correlation functions with such gauge invariant operators. So let's see how to describe gravitational collapse in ADS using ADS-CFT. So you start with some kind of classical matter distribution in ADS. And then if this distribution is sufficiently massive, it will eventually collapse to form a black hole. So in ADS, a classical mass distribution, say if you start with a pure state of the classical mass distribution, this is related to some excited state of Yang-Mills theory of energy of order n squared. So this is very important. And so that means remember in the SUN gauge theory you have n squared degrees of freedom. So that means the almost all degrees of freedom are finitely excited. And in the Yang-Mills theory, if you start with such an excited state, what should happen? Say Yang-Mills theory is a quantum mechanical theory. And this is a very complicated many-body system. If you have a complicated interacting many-body system, if you start with generic excited state, and that state will tend to thermalize. And it will go to equilibrium. And so the equilibrium is what we consider to be a black hole from the ADS language.
Side,
yes.
It's a very delicate balance, right, with this critical phenomenon.
That's right.
I can have a massive plus the mass,
yes,
like black hole,
yes,
collapses,
yes,
and then scatters and doesn't make a black hole.
Right.
So how would I see that?
Right. So yeah. So in the Yamil series side, the you would expect similar thing to happen, but of course we have not seen this explicitly yet. Yeah. So say the analog of this tropic phenomena is not realized explicitly in Yamil series. Right. Oh, that just means that if you start with a state which is excited but not, say, so excited, and then it have the boundary of becoming, say, thermalized or not thermalized, and so what you, yeah, it's a similar translation.
There even it's weird.
Yes. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah.
One number. I know, suddenly
bizarre. Well, it's not clear that either of those numbers is known all that accurate.
So whatever, I'm just saying, I was just trying to address this.
But maybe I should stop too much, but on the Dirac side, really, the phase space linear is too fast.
Yes.
And the boundary.
Yes.
So, excited state is energy of order n squared. So what is the boundary on the angle side? What's the boundary on the angle side?
In the bug that depends on also lots of things, right? You depend on your initial distribution, what kind of configuration you take, and there are many parameters there. But the people take one particular parameter.
Yeah, but and maybe there's an easier way to ask this, which is that you know, on the gravity side, what happens when you don't form a black hole is that everything just disperses.
Yes.
And so you know what. On the Yang-Mills side corresponds to complete dispersal.
Right. Yeah. So in Yang-Mills theory side, if you start with a state, say not very excited state, and then that state will never go to equilibrium, and so black hole is never formed from this language.
Could you say one other comment related to this question, which I was raising in the earlier discussion about resolution of things smaller compared to the ABF that you make.
Right. So yeah, just to say that in the Yamil theory this is not completely work out, but something certainly you can imagine.
But there's also the issue of time scale, like I said in the other day. So the relation goes back out, it's going to collapse. It's a very long enough time is not for
Okay. So then if you want to consider, right, depend on your initial state. Depend on your initial state.
You can wait long enough before you tunnel to a black hole. Because black holes dominate the integrated regime, you make much of it. Unless you have some very finely tuned state.
Yeah, microcanonical, I mean, except for very tiny things.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Let's continue. Say. Yeah. That seems to be deviates too far away from what I'm going to say. And so if you look at the internal black hole, and so here you can perfectly consider to be a pure state. So the whole process would be a pure state. And but if you look at the internal black hole, and that will be related to just the thermal density matrix in the Yamil theory. And so somehow, because the in both process, in the gravitational collapse, in the internal black hole, there are black hole singularities. So black hole singularities should reflect certain features of the thermal equilibrium of the Young-Mills theory. So let me first point out what the other difficulties in carrying out this procedure using Young-Mills theory to understand the black hole singularities. So what are the Young-Mills theory on S3? So these are essentially a bunch of interacting finitely excited harmonic oscillators. So the black hole spacetime is really emergent. So it's really some kind of a collective behavior of this large number of harmonic oscillators. So anything regarding the black hole geometry is not very explicit from the Young-Mills theory point of view. So that's the fascinating part of the emergent space-time, but that's also a disadvantage because if you want to do anything explicit, it's very hard. So almost any question you want to ask naturally from gravity side is actually very hard to answer from Young-Mills theory perspective. And we have answered. So for the last like 7-8 years, people have answered some questions, but answer each of them requires some kind of ingenuity. And also, I think the same type of difficulty I think also faces the say loop quantum gravity approach, or any approach of quantum gravity which the space-time is emergent. And since it's emergent, it cannot be too explicit. And for example, the larger question you would ask first from the gravity side is how do you describe a free infalling observer? But unfortunately, we don't know yet how to really describe this using the Young-Mills theory point of view. And if we know how to describe a free infalling observer, then the probing the singularity would be much easier. So for now, we have to settle something less. So we use the alternative strategies. We start with observables, which are most easily described from a Young-Mills theory point of view, and then see what we can get from there. So what are the simplest Young-Mills theory observables? So the simplest Young-Mills theory observables are such kind of real-time correlation functions. I've written down one of them. So this so-called Whiteman function. So you take engaging wiring operator to separate in time or space a little bit, and then do the to calculate the average in the thermal ensemble. You can also consider retarded functions or Feynman functions, etc. So on the Young-Mills theory side, those quantities they describe, if you perturb your thermal system, thermal equilibrium system a little bit, how the system responds to such kind of perturbation at the linear level. So this is just described slightly away from equilibrium. And from the black hole side, as I said, this kind of operator earlier, they're related to some field, say in the ADS gravity. So they describe the propagation of some small perturbations, say in the black hole geometry. So in the black hole geometry, you then, again, you put some small perturbation and you see what happens. And that's what interpretation of a black hole side. So we will take this gauging wiring operator to have dimension of order n to the power 0, just that does not depend on n. So this corresponding to, say, fundamental string probes in ADS. And the advantage of such probe is that they don't back react to the geometry, at least in the large end limit.
When you say that this is equivalent on the black hole side to free propagation?
Yes.
You mean for a temperature above a certain temperature?
Yeah, I mean just two-point function above certain temperature.
There will be no black hole.
Sure. Yeah. I'm always working in the regime that of the temperature which is due to a black hole.
Yeah, but this is a little worrisome if you're going to claim that you're probing the singularity, because outside the horizon,
yeah, we will see.
Die off, but inside they don't. They blow up on the singularity.
Right. We will see.
Okay.
So let's see what's our strategy to use these observables. First, we would like to identify the manifestations of black hole singularities in such kind of quantities in the limit which is due to the classical gravity. And because we know the black hole singularities are present in the classical gravity, And then we like to find out what happens if we go away from this limit in the Yamil series. Because in the Yamil series, they are just dialable parameters. And then we see, and as I said earlier, if you dial away from lambda equal to infinity, corresponding to take into account that the string have a finite size, and if you go away from n equal to infinity, and this corresponding to you consider the quantum gravitational effect. And then once you understand what's happening from Yamil theory, then we can translate into the Bach language to see what's happening to the singularity. So it's some kind of roundabout way, but. So the main challenges in this kind of strategy is the following. Is that the Bach geometry, as you will see a little bit more explicitly, the Bach geometry is not very explicitly encoded in this kind of observables, which is easy to understand from the Yamil theory point of view. And another challenge is, of course, that the classical gravity corresponding to the lambda equal to infinity limit, so this is really a strongly coupled limit in the Yamil theory. And such a limit are very hard to work with. So these are the main challenges, and we will see how we might be able to go around them. So let me just tell you a little bit how you even compute, say, such kind of correlation function in the Yamil theory side in this Nagin and the Nagin lambda limit. So this follows from the well-defined ADS-FT procedure. Say this is a quantity you want to compute in the boundary theory, in the Yamil theory. So what you do is you compute the two-point function in the Bach for this field corresponding to this operator in the Hartle-Hawking vacuum. So in the black hole, you define a vacuum, you choose a Hartle-Hawking vacuum. And then the R is the radial coordinate and X is the common to the boundary. And then you take, once you compute this quantity, and then you take it to the boundary, and then take these two points to the boundary. And then the boundary value, which after some slight scaling, you get the boundary theory correlation functions. So the bottom line is that this two-point function is the propagator of the free, it's the boundary theory limit of the free propagator of the Bach fields. Sorry? This is Nagin and Nagin lambda limit. Right. So this is the, I'm trying to carry out my first step. And try to.
I was just wondering whether you already have taken that limit.
Right. Yeah, here I'm taking. Yeah, now I'm trying to carry out the first step. So I'm looking at that limit. First, I want to see how to compute this from the Bach gravity side. So this is a standard Penrose diagram. So there's a well-defined procedure of doing that. So I will not tell you the details how to do that. So everything boils down to compute the free propagator in the black hole geometry. And from that you can obtain this boundary correlation function. So it's actually convenient to work in the momentum space. So I will do a Fourier transform. So this omega is the Fourier transform in the time direction, and this L is in the S3 direction. So the angular momentum and the S3. So it's fruitful to look at the behavior of this function in the complex frequency plane, for example, for given L. So what do you find? So there are some features of this function. It's a direct reflection of the horizon in the Bach. Say the fact that the Bach geometry has a horizon has some direct reflection in the analytic behavior of this function. Say the first is that this function actually have a continuous spectrum. Say that this is a continuous function. Just to comment on one point, the G plus actually defines the spectral function for this operator. So this spectral function actually have a continuous spectrum from minus infinity to plus infinity. From the Bach point of view, this because due to the presence of the horizon and all the modes are infinitely redshifted there, so you always have a continuous spectrum. So this is actually a generic feature of, quantized Laplace equation in the black hole geometry. And then you find that there are simple poles in this quantity in the complex frequency plane. And those poles are exactly so-called quasi-normal poles. The quasi-normal poles from the gravity's language. And then the third is that if you Fourier transform this quantity to real time, and then you find for given angular momentum, then this decays exponentially with time. And of course, the scale of the time decay is determined by the imaginary part of the poles, which are closest to real axis. So from the boundary theory point of view, this just tells you that the linear response, say if you perturb the equilibrium a little bit, and the linear response will decay with time, because when the time separation become large, and the theory will go back to equilibrium, then you no longer can detect the small perturbation. And from the Bach point of view, and both this and from the Bach point of view, and as in the standard say interpretation of the quasi-normal modes, is that if you create some small perturbations in the Bach, eventually they will fall into the horizon, and so they will decay with time. So these features are direct reflection of the horizons. And the reason the horizon can be so clearly manifested in the behavior of this function is because the horizon defines the boundary condition for you. Yes?
Exponential decay depends on ADS. I think the black hole in
flat space is power law. Oh, yeah. No, I'm talking about the ADS. That's right. In flat space, it's a power law decay. But in flat space, it's much more complicated. There are lots of issues due to with the asymptotic flatness of the flat space. Yeah.
Question about time reversal.
Right.
The time reversal of an exponentially decaying mode is exponentially growing.
Okay. So that's why. Yeah. So that's a good question. That says in this limit, the Yamil theory is time irreversible. Yeah, we will come to that.
This is just a late intermediate.
Right. Is this what you're asking?
No, I guess I'm saying in the ADS background, take a mode that's exponentially decaying towards the future and just time reverse it.
You always start with the initial condition. Say, I start with black hole geometry, and then I throw a stone, and that will create some wave, and that wave will eventually dies away by falling into the horizon. So what you see is that if you measure the signal, you will eventually see the exponential decays. Yeah, you start with the initial condition.
We have a white hole. This is my point. The extended Schwarzschild ADS spacetime has a white hole singularity. It's perfectly time reflection.
Right, but the
variant, whatever solution you put on it,
but here we probe this geometry by putting some small fluctuation. And this fluctuation you put in is no longer time symmetric.
If the Green function was
No, I'm actually looking at G plus.
That's why he's got both poles in the upper.
Right. That's right. If you only have say advanced or retarded, then you only have half of them.
Right. You can form this black hole naturally, right? Why do you need to have a white hole?
No, we are not forming. Yeah. I'm talking about the thermal ensembles. I'm talking about the internal black hole.
That seems like a valid point. If you had a black hole,
yes,
trying to stay from the downward degree, then you could turn it upside down.
Yes. No. From that point of view, it does not. If you have a black hole, just by the black hole itself corresponding to the thermal density matrix in the Yamil theory, and of course the thermal density matrix is time translation variant. It's time independent. Does not evolve with time. But now we are asking very different question. We are trying to put in some probe in this background, and the statement is that the probe you put in have a time reversible behavior. Yeah, it's talking about small perturbations.
But
Yeah, I'm not talking about time. The white hole itself.
Geometry is time reversal invariant.
Yes.
If you give me initial data.
Yes.
Then it's the metric and extrinsic curvature.
Yes.
Then it comes, puts the same metric, reverse the size of the sine of the extrinsic curvature.
Yes.
That must be growing more.
No, I'm not talking about the gravitational collapse. I'm
No, it's not gravitational collapse, it's just more. Right?
Right, yeah, that's right.
Somehow, the question is really, where is the boundary condition, which defines about
the boundary.
Which says that, in fact, the wave is going out at infinity as well as in the horizon. Where
is
that put in on the
Yang-Mills
side?
Yeah, in the Yang-Mills theory, we put in some perturbation at time equal to zero, and then we look at what happens at time at t greater than zero. We look at the response to that perturbation. Yeah, we are talking about specifically in the thermal equilibrium, I create some perturbation, and then I measure how this perturbation behaves after some time. And then I see this perturbation decays with time.
So you have faults in both the lower and the upper planes, right? So this means that you have both exponential decay and exponential growing.
No, depend on the direction of time. You have to choose your contour, whether you are going forward or backward.
How do you choose your operator O so it doesn't have
No, you don't have to choose operator O. O is a generic operator. Right. Yeah.
You took your N strictly infinity?
Yeah, right now N is strictly infinity.
So you ignore the fact that there would be a different behavior in a thermal ABS network? Because there is another contribution there, which is just thermal ABS.
Right, yeah.
So this you ignore?
Right, yeah. Now I'm just taking N go to infinity.
So if you think about forming a black hole with some collapse in the boundary description, so that's thermalization. And so if you want to think about the converse of that, it's
dethermalization. Right. Yeah, that I'm going to talk about later. Yeah, slightly mentioned later. Okay, so now let's try to probe behind the horizon. So as I said, the horizon is easy to see because the horizon defines the boundary condition for you. But the singularities are much harder to see. It's because, as I said, the boundary correlation function just corresponding to the Bach propagator, you take the boundary theory limit. And to find the Bach propagator, you only need to know the behavior of the wave function in this region 1, which is outside it's outside the horizon. And so let me take this opportunity to remind you the magic of the black hole So T and S3 is common between the bulk and the boundary, and the radial coordinate is in this direction, and then the R becomes the time direction once you cross the horizon, go to the singularity. So under the boundary time corresponding to the standard Schwarzschild time, which starts from minus infinity here and ends at plus infinity there. So if you really want use Yang-Mills theory to describe singularity, the dynamical time inside the horizon must be emergent. So you should be able to see this dynamical time from the Yang-Mills theory side, because now you have a different time here. So now let's see how we do it. So the basic idea is to use analyticity of the metric and analyticity of the Laplace equation for field propagating in the black hole geometry. So even though we only need to know the behavior of the wave function outside the horizon in this region 1, but because the metric is analytic and because the Laplace equations are analytic, and actually so those solutions secretly know the full complexified and black hole geometry. And so this point of view have been emphasized in the earlier papers and also have been used in this second paper to find the signature of the singularity. So we'll talk about some other signatures here. So
why do you get to assume analysis?
No, I don't assume analysis, it's a fact.
It's a fact for a Lipschitz equation, it's not for hyperbolic equations.
No, it's a fact for the Laplace equation for scalar field in the black hole geometry. That's the statement I'm making.
For elliptic equations, it's not a fact for the wave equation, which is the one that's relevant for Lorentz geometry.
For scalar field propagating in the black hole geometry, you can rewrite the equations in terms of a Schrodinger type of equation, and that Schrodinger equation is. Right. Sorry.
The Schrodinger equation because you've already Fourier transformed out the tub. And then what's left really is Laplace's equation.
Yeah.
That's irrelevant.
No, because I have time symmetry here. Depending on what kind of question, I'm asking a very modest question. I'm only asking the behavior of the Laplace equation. I'm not asking the full dynamical evolution, etc. I'm just asking the behavior of the Laplace equation. And because I have time symmetry, so I can do a Fourier transform. There's no problem with that.
Sure, but when you add up all the Fourier modes in an infinite sum, you lose amplitude. That's a basic fact.
No, but my key point here is that you can even see the signature of the black hole singularity from individual modes. I don't need to add them. You will see.
Okay.
You will see. Please be patient.
Sorry.
One of the difficulties in using this kind of a G plus, say this Weitman function, to get the Bach geometry, is that the Bach geometry, because you have to do this procedure, you find the Laplace solution to the Laplace equation, and then you take the boundary limit, and this procedure is very non-local. The local geometry is. It's not very manifestly encoded in this procedure. So to do that, we have to do some. So in order to probe the Bach geometry, we have to do something more, other than just solve the equation. Just solve the equations, you are not going to get a clear sense of what kind of Bach geometry or what features of the Bach geometry is encoded in the Jambier's correlation functions. So in order to probe Bach geometry, let's consider the following limit. I will consider the dimension of the operator to be very large. And then I scale the frequency and the angular momentum by this dimension. And the reason to take the dimension large is because, as I said earlier, the dimension is mapped to the mass of the particle in the Bach. And so this corresponds to a free propagation of a particle in the Bach. If you take a large mass limit, this particle will follow geodesics. So that's the best chance you could to probe the geometry. And then turns out in this limit, what you find is that if you expand your functions in 1 over Liu, in the 1 over dimension after you do this limit, you find it can be written in this form in terms of a function called Z. So this is expansion in the 1 over Liu. And then you find that this function Z is related to the proper distance of a box space-like geodesics with velocity given by I times U and I times K. Right. Sorry.
I'm
looking at the equal to infinity limit.
Okay.
Yeah, right now I just want to get the manifestation of the singularity in this limit of the Jambier theorem, and then we worry about other things.
There are very massive things that make very charged like a rapid meter that
So it turns out this function Z is related to the proper distance of a Bach geodesics with this velocity. So once we specify U and K, So the reason to, now this also gives you a feeling to understand this scaling. So this is like velocity, and this omega then is like momentum. And the only thing is that this I here, which is due to a space-like geodesics. So such initial condition fix the geodesics for you. So you should think your space-time, black hole space-time, really as complexified, just a really like a full complexified manifold. And then such geodesics, they start from the boundary, and then they go to the bulk. And then they will turn around at a certain value of r. Remember, all other coordinates in the bulk are shared by the boundary. The only thing different is this radial coordinate r. So they will turn around at the point of r. So this is a turning point, which also determined by your initial velocity. Determined by your initial velocity. So such a mapping, so for a given velocity, for a given set of boundary frequencies, boundary theory frequencies, I can associate with the geodesics, and the geodesic is characterized by the turning points. So this way, I can establish a relation between the bulk geometry that's characterized by the turning points and the Yamil theory correlation function in the momentum space. So now let's see some examples. Yes.
If in fact this the particles are very massive.
Yes.
And if bulk gives us a problem, the boundary theory knows the coolant, everything is interior.
Yes.
Then shouldn't the boundary theory also know about back reaction? And if so, why is the
No, the back reaction is always zero in this limit I'm working with. Because those I'm already taking the limit and go to infinity. So the mass of those particles always goes to zero in the limits of the So I already take the Planck scale much, much greater than this scale, and then I expand those mass of the particle.
It is related to the same as equal to.
No, it's not equal to. It's actually a Legendre transform.
Oh, it's a musical.
So it's a Legendre transform. Right, yeah, so the limit is that you take the Planck mass, go to infinity limit first, and then you take the mass of the particle large. And you already take the Planck scale, go to infinity, and then you expand around, it's order of limit.
But that's just taking Planck scale to infinity, just looking at classical theory. And the classical theory is back there.
No, classical.
The initial mass is the order of n squared, like you need a mass over n squared to get a back reaction.
Right.
The angle is infinity. And these masses are big, but they're not as big as n squared in the sense for life.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so they are parametric, as I said earlier, they're parametric always order one, but in the end you expand them. They're independent. So let us look at some kind of relations. Let's consider, say, for example, the angular momentum equal to zero, and consider real frequencies. And it turned out, they pick a frequency on the real axis, turned out that's associated to some kind of geodesics in the Euclidean section of the black hole. And in particular, the turning point of the geodesics goes to the boundary if you take the frequency to be very large. So I give you three examples here. So the one is close to the zero. So this turning point is actually very much in the interior. And this is the negative frequency, so this goes to the other way. And then if I take the frequency to be very large, and then the geodesics very close to the boundary, the turning point very close to the boundary. So this is the familiar RUV relation from the in the DCFT, is that just say, UV in the Yamil theory, UV in the Yamil theory is related to the IR in the bulk. So now let's look at what's happening to the geodesic in the Lorentzian space-time. So you find if you consider, say, an imaginary frequency in the Yamil theory, and then that's mapped to geodesics in the Lorentzian section of the space-time, start from one boundary and then go across the horizon and then go to the other boundary. And if you take the imaginary frequency to be very large, and then that will, the turning point will approach the singularity. I should mention that those geodesics have been used earlier in the paper by Fedotkovsky et al. In finding the signatures of the singularities in Yamil theory. And now if you take the frequency to be zero, and then this just gives you a geodesic just cross the horizon. And this line, this surface is actually shared by the Euclidean and Lorentzian geometry. So you can actually see it from both ways, from this way or from this way.
These are all space-like?
Yeah, these are all space-like. So now, an important point to emphasize is that when you go to a large imaginary frequency, you are approaching, the turning point is approaching the singularity. And also, keep in mind that this direction is actually the time direction. So actually, time inside the horizon seems to be related to the imaginary frequency from the Yamil theory point of view. And if you go to large frequency, then you more approach to the time in the horizon. Yeah, time in close to the singularity. So let me just summarize with this diagram. So again, we consider the complex frequency plane in the Yamil theory. And then here I label in each part of the frequency plane and how the frequency is related to the turning point of the corresponding bulk geodesics. Say if the large real frequency, the turning point is very close to the boundary, and the very large imaginary frequency, the turning point is very close to the singularity. And it's very important that actually you have this kind of infinite line of poles, quasi-normal poles, separate this asymptotic infinity and this asymptotic infinity, because otherwise you can do analytic continuation between them. But with this pose, the analytic continuation can only be done through the horizon. Yes?
So from field theory point of view, looking at imaginary frequency is the same as taking your theory in Euclidean
No.
It will be discrete, but you can still take large frequency.
No. It's essential that the... Yeah, this is a fine point to explain, but it's important to. Yeah, but you're asking a very good question. But it's important to emphasize that the behavior on the imaginary axis here have nothing to do with the Euclidean correlation functions. And it takes 5 minutes to explain. It's simple to explain, but it's just slightly technical.
It's because you're using the Whiteman function instead of the Feynman function.
It's because it's the following. Yeah, let me just do it. So if you look at the retarded, so the retarded have a pose here, but it's analytic in upper half plane. And so the behavior here, quantized frequency in the imaginary axis is related to the Euclidean correlation functions. And so this is retarded. So if you look at the advanced, the advanced have a pose here, and then the behavior here is related to the Euclidean correlation functions. But when you take the Whiteman function, you're taking this part and this part.
But Whiteman function is just a combination of retarded
and... Right. It's a combination of this part and this part, and not that part and that part. And that part gives you the Euclidean correlation functions. So analytically, they're very complicated involved. It's not simple relation. It's not a simple relation. Right, so we just said the singularity is related to the behavior of the Yamil theory in here, so let's try to find the behavior. And try to find the behavior. See what are the predictions from the gravity and corresponding to the Yamil theory in here. So then the manifestation of the singularity is the following. So let me remind you the black hole metric. So the F blows up at I equal to zero. And so essentially the proper distance associated with the time and dt squared actually become infinite. And also the sphere shrink to zero size at I equal to zero. So what you find is that for G plus, when omega goes to plus minus I infinity, actually decays exponentially with frequency. So this beta tilde is some number which can be obtained from the black hole mass, for example, from the mass of the black hole. And you can actually, with a slightly technical effort, you can show that this exponential decay is precisely a consequence of FR and blows up at the singularity at I equal to zero. And another manifestation is that if you look at the logarithm, so this z and z function I defined earlier, which is related to the logarithm of g plus. So this is the quantity directly related to the say geodesic distance. And so this quantity, if take the derivative of the angular momentum, and take the energy go to infinity, imaginary infinity, and then you find this quantity diverge in this way. And then you can actually also, with some effort, you can show that this is directly related to the curvature and curvature divergence associated with the three sphere, the three sphere shrink to the zero size. Yes.
So now, I mean, it seems like Alvarez's objection about Back's reaction becomes acute because, even if the perturbations are small, those small perturbations will blow up on the singularity, and the singularity won't look like that at all. And so if the Yang-Mills theory is supposed to know about the classical theory, then why does it give things that look like that?
No, but this is a particular limit of Yang-Mills theory. And this is a particular limit. Right now we are doing a translation of the dictionary. In the classical gravity you see a singularity, and the classical gravity corresponding to a particular limit of Yang-Mills theory. I want you first to see what the translation of the singularity in the Yang-Mills theory side.
Okay.
And then I claim, then I claim that's the manifestation of the singularity from Yang-Mills theory point of view. And from Yang-Mills theory, everything is emergent. You don't see the singularity immediately. That's what I said at the beginning. Everything is emergent, so it's very in a very convoluted way.
The consequence
of vanishing quadratically.
What's your agreement?
No, I don't.
He's not trying to say that this is the way that the theory is singular here. I think there's just moral limits where you see
right.
The singularity happening. If you ask what's happening really in the actual theory, that might be different behavior than this, because I think this is extracted in a way that sort of is ignoring that there's all kinds of things.
This happens in the particular limit of the Yang-Mills theory.
What is the limit in which I get classical relativity and ignoring back reaction?
Yes.
And what is the difference in which I get classical relativity including back reaction?
I don't understand that there's a well-defined, I don't think there's a well-defined procedure in the classical gravity to include the back reaction. There's no well-defined approximation procedure to do that. Right now, what I'm doing is just say in the classical gravity limit without back reaction to see what's the manifestation.
So you would have taken a probe which would have been more and
yes.
Component.
Right.
Or whatever, you need to take a bigger.
No, that still won't have a back reaction in this limit. In this limit. Because parametrically, it's n squared versus n.
Okay, n squared.
Right.
Well, I'm saying that the possible thing you cannot take it, and that's what some people do all the time. Data can be weak data, in fact, linearized data.
No, but I'm not considering, but I'm not. Your data already have a much larger mass than what I'm taking here.
No, I think that's true.
His perturbation would have to be of order n squared in order to have any non-squared.
Right. And I'm always considering.
Yeah, yes. You're saying, m goes to infinity.
Because otherwise you have a suppression of 1 over n times anything, and n is already taken to infinity before the other thing is good. So therefore, there is a limit in which you can take relativity included back there. And so you double that there. So what are the differences?
And the difference was, is that the perturbation you add itself has to have a mass of order n squared in order for the money back there to evolve.
It's not like taking one quantum of a field.
Right, I'm taking.
Which has an energy h bar omega, and then taking h bar to zero.
Yeah.
One quantum of the field will not back react because you're taking h bar to zero. And so its classical amplitude is going to zero. So these probes are exciting one quantum of
the field. That's right, that's right.
And you're taking the limit h bar to zero.
So that's what will only tell us about the properties of a fixed space time.
Yeah.
Arbitrarily small classical perturbations of that.
Sure, sure.
Only the fixed space.
Sure, sure. That's what I said at the beginning. As I said at the beginning, we are considering a quantum field theory in the rigid space time and considering very small probe which does not back to this geometry.
Okay.
So this is the key.
How generic do you expect this diagnosis for a singularity? For example, if you have something like a classical.
Yes.
Behavior,
yes.
Going on in the singularity.
Right.
Something more complicated. Do you expect people to diagnose singularity?
That I don't know, but no, I don't think this simple thing will be able to diagnose it. You need something more fancy in the Yamil theory to do it. And so I have something wild later, if I can reach it. And so. K is angular momentum, that's right.
Didn't you somehow make it?
That's right. Yeah, complexified.
What is this in terms of the geodesics we kind of call it?
Right. Right.
What does this divergence mean?
Right. So this really means that so your geodesics really have a small part passing through this part which have a high curvature.
Yeah.
And so when you take that limit, you really see that high curvature.
Is it like moving one of the ends on the sphere
somehow? It's a sensitivity to the whether you don't have angular momentum or you have angular momentum. And when you have tiny angular momentum, you really see this. There's a huge difference between because the sphere shrinks to zero sides. Because sphere shrinks to zero sides. Right. So now I have talked to you. What are the say manifestation for that particular classical limits, Nagy and Nagy lambda limit in the Yamil theory? And now, let's try to carry out the second step. Try to go away from that, see what's happening. Of course, go away from that, as I said earlier, is very complicated. So we can only see something. So we can only say something qualitative. So first, let's look at what should be the generic behavior of such a, say, S super Yamil theory on the three sphere at the finite n, at the finite SUN group. So first, this theory have a discrete spectrum, discrete energy spectrum, and the theory is obviously time reversible. And in such theory, H plus T is always oscillatory and recurring. Say such kind of Whiteman function. And so if you look at the momentum space, the Whiteman function actually have very simple analytic structure. It's essentially a sum of discrete data functions. So because you have a discrete energy spectrum, so you essentially have a sum of discrete data functions on the real axis. So now let's try to complain of finite n versus infinite n. So the finite n, as I said earlier, we have discrete spectrum and the time reversible. And the time reversible is reflected in that operators have discrete spectral functions. And the real-time correlation functions are oscillatory. So these are the reflection of the time reversible. And then the Whiteman functions is the sum of the data functions on the real axis that have very simple analytic structure. So what we find at the infinite n earlier from supergravity, So there we did not probe and directly the continuous energy spectrum. So I put a question mark there. And if you there we find that finite temperature, sufficiently high temperature, finite temperature, and if you put the small perturbations, then the theory in the system actually time is reversible. The perturbation always decays to zero. And so this reflected in that operators have continuous spectral functions. And as I said earlier, this is reflect to the presence of the horizon. And the real-time correlation functions decay with time. Again, it's related to the horizon. The horizon absorbs everything. And then we have seen that in the Whiteman function, you see very rich analytic structure, which indicative, say, of the black hole geometry and the singularities. So now let's think about this again. At the finite end, in the frequency plane, if you look at the Whiteman function or spectral density function, you just see a discrete sum of discrete set of data functions. And now let's take n to be very large. Take n to be very large. And then those points will become denser and denser. But suppose you always keep n, no matter how large, but n strictly finite. Then it's always a discrete sum of data functions. But now, let us make approximation. Say, take n to be very large, but finite, but make approximation, we expand in 1 over n. So that's essentially treating n equal to infinity. When you expand in 1 over n, that's what we found from gravity, is that you see this rich analytic structure. And then, this discrete sum of data function become a continuous function. Once this become a continuous function, then you can analytically continue off the real axis. And then here we see now in the rich analytic structure of this function in the large n limit, in the large n approximation, you see all those structures indicative of the geometry in the bulk of the ADS. So this says that horizons and singularities must be just approximate concepts of an infinite n approximation. And also this explains why to describe an infolding observer is hard from the Yamil theory perspective. It's because the infolding observer is actually really an approximate concept. It's not something which intrinsically defined in the Yamil theory. It's only something very specific to the to an infinite n feature and to this particular approximation. So that's why the infolding observer is actually very hard to describe in this theory.
This is for all values in G, I'm sorry.
And this is for all values of n, that's right.
I'm
working with n and the lambda. Right, so it's fine. Yeah, all values of G, that's right.
You're saying that you know the singularity is not resolved by alpha prime
effect? No, I'm not making that statement, I'm just contrast between the infinite n and the finite n.
Finite n is sufficient, but maybe not necessary.
No, for this for the geometry to appear, infinite n is crucial. But whether the singularity, et cetera, I'm just saying for all those geometric to appear, infinite n is special. It's crucial.
Even an infinite finite
Right. Yeah, that's a possibility, but I'm not addressing that. That's right.
Okay, this right-hand side is infinite n and large random. I mean, it could be the infinite n and weak random. Yes. This picture is like a technique for you.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm just saying, yeah, I'm emphasizing, in order to have this kind of picture, you must have infinite n. At the finite n, there's nothing to talk about.
I mean, for large lambda and large n, you could have a black hole which is macroscopic, and you would say it's geometric. But you're saying that there are some precise sets it's not.
That's right. It's only approximation. Yeah, it's approximate concept. That's right. It's something.
Black hole like mass cubed, and so somehow you know this approximate thing that really isn't there. The Yang-Mills theory has to tell you that you know this hangs around for a time you know much longer than the age of the universe, and that seems like a funny thing for the Yang-Mills theory to be telling us.
Yeah, I mean, effective field theory is in which there is a black hole.
Right.
There is a geometry.
That's right. In this particular approximation, so the geometry is the emergent concept from you doing a particular approximation.
Yeah, but where does the enormous time scale come from?
It's related to n. Yeah, it's related to n. Right. So, So now let me offer something slightly speculative. So we start with n equal to 4 super Yamils. And typically we talk about n super Yamil, we're talking about the real frequency, say in real time, corresponding to real frequency. And then we say at least, and then once you load the function in the real frequency, then you can do analytic iteration to construct the function on the imaginary axis. So it seems like this defines a different theory for you. And the message we got earlier is that it seems in this theory that the physics inside the horizon is manifestly reflected, it's manifestly at least described. Say each point here will corresponding to the time inside the horizon. Just like each point here is related to the radial distance from LRUV point of view. And it's important to emphasize such kind of relation is only possible in the large N limit. Again, only when you have a continuous spectrum you can do something like this. You can do something like this. So maybe
I missed the main point. Can you just repeat that in one sentence?
Right. Yeah. The point is, give you the Yamil theory in the large N limit. Say suppose you load the suppose you can do the measurement to load the function on the real axis. And then I can do analytic iteration to find the its behavior in the imaginary axis. And I can now imagine the behavior on the imaginary axis define a different theory for me, which is very non-locally related to original theory. And from what we learned earlier is that the behavior inside the horizon singularity seems to be more manifest in this theory.
What do you call it, a different theory?
No, it's the same theory, just written in a completely different variable.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so that's why I say these two can be related to each other.
In the large N limit, you have the bone.
That's right. In the pole, so the analytic continuation have to be done along here, right? It cannot straightforwardly down from infinity. That's right. So they're always connected through this part, which is related to the horizon in the bulk.
Those poles are made form a continuous. There's a branch cut on the horizontal
line. No, it's always just pure simple poles. In the infinite end.
In the infinite end, they don't form a continuum. I'm just confused about it.
The delta functions that are there at finite.
Sorry, what are you asking?
I'm not,
those are the delta functions.
Yeah,
that's right. Right. The delta functions become a continuous function.
Something else that has a branch up
there. Right. So maybe a better understanding of this theory, say whether it's possible to define such a theory, say related to your original theory, such a very non-local way. So maybe that can tell us how to describe, say, an infinite observer and its fate, or maybe the final state proposal by Gary and Martina. And again, we should say this kind of thing should only be possible. It should be only possible in some construction which is intrinsically large N. So let me just try to not consider, say, some. Again, very heuristic rough picture. And what happens to a gravitational collapse at the finite end, which first due to Martina. Say, suppose if you start with a generic initial state in the pure Yamil theory, say of sufficiently high energy, so you always need to energy square in order to back react. So that corresponds to some initial matter in the bulk, which is sufficiently massive. So then this state will eventually approach an equilibrium and stay there, possibly for a very long time, say exponential order n square. So from the bulk point of view, say this corresponds to a black hole formation, if you sit from afar, and if you really sit on this collapsing matter, you might see a big crunch. And now, Yamil theory at the finite end tell us at a certain point, if you wait long enough, then a large fluctuation can happen at a certain point, and then the system is back to a long equilibrium state. And so from the up, from the back point of view, this is really like a white hole explosion to form matter. And say, if you can really describe an infalling observer which stays with this initial matter which falls into the black hole, so maybe for him, it's like a transition from Big Crunch to a Big Bang.
This looks very different from Gary's and Ron's quantum state. This looks more like what
we said. No, I think their picture should be hidden somewhere, which we don't know how to describe it.
Why is that?
Yeah, their picture should be hidden around how you describe this scene.
Long-term evolution is that, you know, there's this big bang, big
right.
crunch, and then that and things come out of it again. So
I agree. This picture is very similar to your picture.
But can I ask a question? You use the word white hole, but why shouldn't I think it's just a massive thermal fluctuation where all the Hawking radiation that's coming out instead of trickling out just comes out all at once? Which seems like a very different picture to me than a white hole.
Sorry, what do you mean that by the?
Well, so the Hawking radiation is a stochastic phenomenon.
Right, right.
Usually it just trickles out, but there's some amplitude that it would all come out at once.
No, Hawking radiation have always been there. So you have to wait for a long time. And during this long time, they're always Hawking radiation.
Right.
And then suddenly, you can. It depends on your language whether you want to call it a white hole eruption or just Hawking radiation suddenly say become dramatic. Right.
The amplitude for the thing just decayed sort of all at once and looked like an air hole.
Right. Right.
It looked like a white hole is heated minus the entropy in.
Right. So I think your picture is not, say, Hawking in the 19, like in the 70s, he wrote a paper, maybe, he argued with Hawking radiation, you cannot even distinguish a white hole. I think that's your perspective. How can you distinguish between the just Hawking radiation suddenly come out with a white hole? I agree from this point of view.
I'd like to ask a different question about the Hawking radiation.
Yes.
So the black hole sitting there, it's very stable. It's like a thermal, quasi-thermal state in the gauge theory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, do we know how to describe what happens when one Hawking quantum is radiated? What does that correspond to in this almost thermal state of the gauge theory?
The black, right. You should imagine the black hole is inside the box. Say the black hole keep radiating and the radiation keep come back. It's really a thermal equipment. The radiation does not escape. They always come back.
I thought we were talking about a small black hole that we formed. I was assuming that.
Sorry. I was talking about the fall. I should have said that at the beginning. I always assume you form a large enough black hole. So I still have lots of to say. How many minutes you can give me? Maybe not a lot, there's something, maybe 10 minutes.
Well, let's see, there's a question. If you can finish up in 10 minutes, and
right.
That's fine. Or if you have a lot to say and there's interest, we could break for tea and come back.
Yeah, I think about 10 to 15 minutes we should be able to settle it.
Well, perfect. We're looking at the
right. Yeah, I think 10 to 15 minutes should be enough, right? Okay. So let me again stress the difference between finite end and infinite end we have said earlier. So in the finite end, all this discrete oscillatory, but at the infinite end, you have time reversible, etc. So, right. So these are the statements regarding small perturbations of thermal equilibrium or small perturbations of internal black hole. That's right. So this raises questions if you compare these two columns. So first, he said, can we actually find a quantitative understanding from a Yamiosity point of view? How this structure emerges in large N limit? Just how to go from here to here when you take n go to infinity. Say, for example, an arrow of time should emerge So also another question is, does two-loop coupling play an essential role here? And how sensitive does the result we find at strong coupling using the classical gravity depend on the strong coupling? So this will answer the question. Say this would attempt to answer the question which Eva asked earlier regarding whether alpha prime resolves the singularity or not. So understanding this question should also shed light on how the analytic structure related to the singularity arises in the large N limit. So the key question we would like to understand is why those analytic structures associated with the singularity arise in the large N limit of the Yang-Mills series. What kind of physics they represent? So we don't have. So then I will talk about some preliminary attempts in trying to answer those questions. But let's start from trivial thing. Just start with free theory, the other end. So we just talk about lambda equal to infinity. Now let's talk about lambda equal to zero. So what you find is the energy spectrum in the free going for super Yang-Mills on S3 is actually quantized in the inverse radius of S3, because you expand everything in terms of, say, harmonics on S3, then you find that the free series spectrum is always quantized that. It's always quantized. So the energy spectrum is not only discrete in the free series, in the large N limit, but also equal spaced. And since the spectral functions only depend on the level differences, so the spectral function actually also discrete at infinite n. So the real-time correlation function is always oscillatory because you have a discrete spectral functions. So just to elaborate a little bit on what I said in the last transparency, so the free series spectrum is like this. And so you have order 1 energy and order n squared. So for the question related to black hole, we are interested in the energy, in the state of energy n squared. And they can probed by the temperature of order 1. So we are interested in this kind of correlation functions. So this is again, this is a Niemann representation of the white function momentum space, and you see that this is related to the energy. The spectrum here is related to the level difference. And to the energy difference of your energy spectrum, and though this though MN and tells you how O behaves between the different states. So in the free theory, because all of them are quantized in some basic unit, so this thing has to be, say, data function, like cannot be continuous, even in the infinite N limit. So now let's go to weak coupling. And so your first urge to do is let's do planar perturbation at the infinite n. Say, only look at planar diagrams. So one thing you can check is that at weak coupling at any finite order in planar perturbation theory, so this includes to sum over some like Dyson type of self energy. And it's, again, you find the discrete spectral functions, and the real function and the real time function is oscillatory, at least in the perturbation theory. And also there's another important thing is that below at zero temperature, the planar perturbation actually have a finite radius of convergence in the complex lambda plane. That's just because the lambda and the number of planar diagrams grow like a power. So you can always make your lambda small enough so that the series is convergent. So if this is true also at the finite temperature, then one would conclude that the real-time correlation function should be analytic at lambda equal to zero. So given those behavior at the free theory and the perturbation theory, you would conclude that the discrete spectral function at small non-zero coupling, you should be able to find the discrete spectral function and oscillatory at real-time. Then that will tell you actually the coupling constant plays a very crucial role in getting the strong coupling behavior. Say you have to say some finite value of coupling in order to achieve that.
Sorry, I'm just following that step just because your top line was that any finite order in planar perturbation theory, the discrete spectral functions are oscillatory.
Right.
So here you should be talking about the full spectral functions, including perhaps all orders and some perturbation theory. How many of those
are? Right. Yeah. So that based on that convergent, that theory is convergent, and that behavior, based on that, the behavior should be analytic at lambda equal to zero. Yeah, should be analytic at lambda equal to zero. If it's analytic at lambda equal to zero, then this should follow. And I think it's convergent at the.
Actually, have
a
proof of that. You need more than just counter.
No. I don't have a proof of this. Right. I have a counter proof of that.
What?
I have a counter proof of that. Not a proof. I show this is not true.
Oh.
Yeah, this is just to.
Keep setting up a straw man.
Right. So.
If you're setting this up.
Oh, okay. Right. So I say, if it's.
We are
statements,
right?
Right.
But
yeah, if it's true, then it's
false.
But it's not going to be true.
Right. So now, let's look at final t. But what you can show is that you're creating correlation functions and partition functions. They do have a finite radius of convergence. And that's not so different from if you do.
Is this related to the fact that you live on S3 and not in R4?
Yeah, this is crucial. So, on R4, I'm not sure. On R4, there are problems associated with infrared divergences and UV divergence. Such kind of convergence statement is always hard to make. But in quantum mechanics, can be made cleanly. So, what do I find for real time correlation function? Say such time which separate can be separated in time, you find that they have a zero radius convergence in lambda if you take the long time limit. So if you take this g plus t, if you take t goes to infinity, and then you find in that limit that actually in the larger limit have a zero radius convergence. So this actually
what is the source of that?
Yeah, I will tell you. I will give you a heuristic argument, but I will not give you a precise argument. I will give you a heuristic argument. So this can be supported by Feynman diagrams, but I will not give you that argument. So we can construct a subset of diagram to show it's divergent.
Not canceled by any other
sum of now, all this kind of proof is always order of magnitude estimate. So I just show at this order, order in power series can be of this order. So if magic cancellation does not happen, then there will be divergence. Of course, I cannot rule out. Right.
This happens for any non-zero temperature.
No, high enough to be n squared. So you probe the degree freedom of n squared. So as I said earlier, you want to probe this energy range. But you don't need to very high temperature. The temperature of order one of the radius of the sphere is enough. So this actually implies the theory is intrinsically non-perturbative in the long time limit. And the perturbation theory and the free theory are not really reliable guides to what could happen to a tiny but non-zero coupling.
Is this just saying that you excite collective modes at long times, like hundred
modes? No, I have not been able to formulate the answer in terms of Langridge. It might be, I don't know. So let me give you a physical explanation. So let's again go back to the free theory spectrum. So I said that they are equal spaced, but there's a very important fact, is that if you look at the state of energy order one, say independent of n, you find the degeneracy of order one. But if you look at the state of energy n squared, so I use the thick line here to indicate that those states actually have very huge degeneracy. The expansion of order n squared degeneracy. That's just due to the matrix structure of the theory. And now, since you have a such huge degeneracy, now you turn on a tiny perturbation, you have to do degenerate perturbation theory, at least. So let's turn. So you expect the degeneracy generically broken. And actually you expect that because you have such a huge degeneracy, so the typical spacing after you, say, diagonalize your degenerate perturbation theory, and then the typical spacing is actually exponential magnitude order n square spacing. And actually more importantly, is that actually your degenerate perturbation theory also does not work. It's because what you can show is that for a typical degenerate energy level, they split into an energy range of lambda n. So if you keep a fixed lambda, no matter how small, in a large n limit, the range of the level separation actually goes to infinity. So if you go back to this diagram, so the level separation here is always order 1, but once you turn on a small perturbation, then you find that the energy here splits into infinite range at any non-zero value of lambda. That's just related to the Nijian counting of actually this statement can be rephrased into the behavior of a two-point function. Two-point function is order n square, so this is like a square root of that. So at least this gives you a feeling that in a large n limit, the physics is really pretty non-perturbative, say in the energy range which you probe, which is order n square.
Are 2 and 3 consistent with each other? It seems like if the splitting is so big, then why is the spacing so small?
No, this splitting does not affect this behavior. That only changes the power, the prefactor logarithm in n. So this is expansion in n square. And this splitting at most affects some kind of prefactor, some power and prefactor. Yeah, won't change this behavior.
Basically, the point is that you have these two sets of degenerate levels, and they split largely, then they overlap.
That's right.
So you get a dispersion of these things, you get a band, but you have many, many bands overlap. Yeah. So the average space between the two different levels is too small.
So let me make some philosophical remark, like between Euclidean world and Lorentzian. So in the Euclidean correlation functions, they're only sensitive to level spacing of order temperature, because Euclidean correlation function, you at most probe that. But the Lorentzian correlation function, which I wrote the, I think it's too much to go back. So if you look at the Lehmann representation of a real-time correlation functions, as I said, it's sensitive to the level spacing. And there, if you take the time long enough, then you can actually probe arbitrarily small level spacing. So you see from here there's a tension between the long time limit and really doing a and the large n limit, or doing the perturbation. So this really explains the difference between the Lorentzian and Euclidean correlation functions in perturbation theory. This striking difference between the Lorentzian and Euclidean also is reminiscent of the, say, in the black hole geometry. Say the Euclidean section of the black hole is smooth and everything seems to be well defined, but in the Lorentzian geometry you actually have a singularity, you have a horizon, etc. So this also highlights that in the Lorentzian geometry the non-time behavior should be something very important to watch. So let me just conclude. Did I finish my 15 minutes?
So your idea was thinking about it from a black hole point of view, that the behavior of the Engels theory,
yes,
finite lambda,
yes,
no matter how small,
yes,
more typical of lambda equals infinity.
That's right. That's right. So let me just final remark. So if you look at the energy spectrum, so the fact that the energy spectrum become in continuous actually does not immediately imply the spectral function of a generic operator become continuous. So in order to see that the spectral function become continuous, we actually need to look at the behavior of this function. So that's the thing which go into the Lehmann representation, which you really look at look at this behavior, because if the state only connect to states differ by, say, fixed amount of energy, you still get discrete spectral and function. And of course, this is a very complicated question. But given that the large number of states involved, so the one thing one can try to do is we can try to approximate the perturbed Hamiltonian. So you start free theory, you put some small perturbation. You put the perturbed Hamiltonian, say, as a random matrices. Actually, if you look at the structure a little bit more carefully, it's actually a sparse, very extremely sparse, and the bandits and random matrices. So it's not the standard random matrices. So using some argument, which I'm not going to give you, you can show that this matrix element between the generic state of energy one, E1, E2, is actually of this form. And this omega E is the density of state. Yeah, so the point to show this formula is really that in the quantum chaos literature, this behavior has been argued to be a hallmark of the quantum chaos. So there might be, and also in the quantum chaos or quantum statistical physics literature, say, and people can argue, like for example, Mark. Yeah, Mark Srednicki has worked on that. Say, given this behavior, the system always thermalizes, and the error of time always emerges. Say such a behavior, you can always say implies that G plus W, say G plus omega, have a continuous spectrum, and G plus T actually decays with time. So you see that error of time has emerged. So let me conclude. Yeah, just read it for you. So the first, that the horizon and the singularities, so those kind of geometric structure are related to certain things which only emerge in the large general approximation. It's not the intrinsic part of the quantum theory. So then the second message I want to convey is that it might be possible to push the strongly coupled behavior of the Yamil's correlation functions, which observe that strong coupling, all the way to almost zero coupling. But in order to really match that, we still need the non-perturbative tactics. So thank you.
This business of zero coupling, are you arguing that the perturbation theory for the finite are non-asymptotic?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Along asymptotic. That's right. Sorry, you say. Say it again.
Is the perturbation theory
asymptotic? It's not coming to your argument.
Yeah. I think it's not asymptotic. That's right.
I mean, it just simply fails.
That's right. That's right.
I'm not so sure about this large end statement.
Okay.
Because for finite end, there is also model. The geometrical
for finite end days.
There is a geometrical description.
Okay.
Which would be to have thermal ADS. So that's the two topologies sitting together.
Yes.
And as you know, once they are together for a long time, it's the thermal ADS one which will dominate.
Yes. That's right.
That one will dominate over the black hole.
Sure.
So that's why you see in the young males a total change in the structure.
Sure.
But if you went into more detail, you could maybe fish out that there is also that other black hole. So it's just becoming much more difficult once you have thermal ADS there. But it doesn't mean that you still can't fish up something of the black hole.
Right. No.
There. So, and maybe there's more stuff there geometrically. But so I would say it's clear that there should be a change at finite end.
Yes.
Because for large times, the thermal ADS will dominate. That is a totally different geometrical picture.
Right.
The other guy is there as well. So you should be able to somehow get information
both. Right. So I think your picture is still say your picture is like the following. Say let's evaluate the integral. Say evaluate the Yamil's partition function. So your picture is the sum of the saddle points. Right, it's a sum of the saddle point. It's a sum of the saddle point. The black hole is the leading saddle point, and then you have other saddle points. And So I think it's what is non-clear, or what I think is clear is that the set of point approximation at least is not going to give you the correct non-time behavior in the Yamil theory. So I would say the set of point approximation, which is semi-classical, it's not enough. At least it's not enough to address these kind of questions.
You can right. Both, and if you are very, if you work very hard on your needs, you probably can learn both.
Oh, sure. The first one. No, I'm not saying you cannot learn from that. I'm just saying this is the question of principle. Yes.
Because I think there are several different issues here. For instance, your Penrose diagram would appear to me to be time symmetric.
Yes.
Right? With no arrow of time, the arrow of time and the concept of temperature arises when you focus on a particular causal region or what's accessible to a particular observer.
Right.
Then you have an arrow of time associated with that causal region.
That's right.
The focal structure is still.
Well, fine. No. Well, sure. I agree with what you say, but that's not the. That's not in contradiction from what I say. I'm just saying I'm talking about the arrow of time from a very specific perspective.
From very specific perspective,
and still from that perspective, you can still see the huge difference between the finite n and the infinite n. And that's the issue I'm interested in. Right.
Okay. All right. Well, one more question.
Okay. So you have taken. I mean, everything you're talking about was on S3, right?
Yes.
Now, if you study field theory in R3.1, the dual description still has a singularity, right? But it could be simpler because you don't have all this business with discreteness, and you don't have, you know, all these small black holes.
No, I think actually in that limit, in some sense it's simpler, but in some sense it's more complicated. It's there, you have, so here I emphasize the continuous spectrum from the large n limit. But there, continuous can come from two sources, from the R3 and from the large n. So it's much harder to disentangle them.
So what happens, for example, to this, you know, two-point Wittmann function
yes.
that used to decay, you know, exponentially along the complex frequency
yes.
axis? Does it still do the same thing if you study field theory in flat space?
No, you cannot even make the statement there. For the flat theory, even for free theory, a free scalar field at finite temperature, it can decay, can exponentially decay with time, just because you have a continuous spectrum.
But marginally,
Right. Yeah. So yeah. I'm just saying that's kind of Just say the putting R3, you're putting one more layer of structure conceptually.
Pretty weird on the geometrical end because if you're looking at a small black hole, it falls past the ABS horizon and it's gone.
Right.
Okay. Let's thank Tom.